It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, new research looks at the relationship between cash bail and high incarceration rates and what can be done to improve the system. Now, Milwaukee rolled out its latest city budget this week, and it includes staffing cuts to firefighters, libraries, and the police department, though the dollar amount for police goes up. In a speech to Milwaukee's Common Council, Mayor Cavalier Johnson zeroed in on two causes: the state system that helps fund local services, known as shared revenue, and a state-imposed limit on how much local governments can raise in taxes and fees.
We are tightly constrained by limited revenue. In fact, constrained is not the right word. We're hamstrung. We're forced to cut long-established services because we simply just don't have the money that we need.
We're taking a look at how these state policies affect the health of local governments around the state and what it means for services in your community. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What local services are important to you? Libraries, parks, police, maybe all of the above. Have you seen cuts to any of those services in your own community? Do you think cities, local governments should be able to raise, say, a 0.5% sales tax like counties are able to do right now? Or take off property tax limits? Are there changes you'd like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob Henken is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Jason Stein is research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
Now, Rob, you at Policy Forum have written a couple of reports related to shared revenue. First of all, can you tell us, what do we mean when we talk about our shared revenue system in the state? How does the money flow?
So essentially, this is a system that dates all the way back to 1911, when the state first established a state income tax, and state leaders at the time said essentially that we are going to preserve for state government the ability to levy income taxes. We are not going to allow our local units of government to do the same. But in return, we're going to make a commitment that some portion of the income taxes we collect as the state will be shared with our local units of government. Essentially, the same principle also has been followed with regard to the sales tax over time, with the exception, as you noticed in your opening, or said in your opening, that counties are allowed to do a 0.5-cent sales tax. So when we talk about the shared revenue program, it's an appropriation in the state budget that exists for both counties and for municipal governments. The state appropriates funds every year. Those are distributed via a formula, and it constitutes a form of revenue sharing, whereby state government is sharing those sources of revenue that it is able to collect exclusively with those local units of government. As I'm sure we'll get into, the problem is that over time, that sharing principle has really diminished to the point of even disappearing. That appropriation, the overall state appropriation for the shared revenue program, has essentially stayed the same in non-inflation adjusted, so just nominal terms, has not gone up for the past 25 years or so. And that clearly is squeezing local units of government.
And Jason, Rob mentioned income tax and sales tax. That leaves property tax, which local governments can assess, but even there are limits. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So in Wisconsin, for cities, villages, counties, technical college districts, they live under what is called levy limits. And essentially what that is it limits the property taxes that they levy for their operating budget, for their ongoing operations, can't rise by any more than the percentage increase essentially in new construction or development in that local government's territory. And, you know, there are a number of communities from Milwaukee, the large city, to, you know, many small towns in the state that are just not getting very much new construction every year. Even when inflation was 1.5% to 2% a year, they weren't necessarily getting that. And now that we have inflation at, you know, 8% or 9% a year, they're certainly not getting that.
I want to give a listen now to Jerry Deshane, head of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. This is him talking back in May to the morning show here on the Ideas Network about how this all affects local communities.
There's a disconnect with how well the state is doing with its budgets and how challenged local governments are doing. And the bottom line, it's because the system we have doesn't work. The system is supposed to share money from the state to local governments. That's just not happening.
And Rob, that's what you were pointing to just a few moments ago. Where is that leaving local communities, like whether we're talking about the biggest city, Milwaukee, or smaller cities and villages around the state?
So there is a distinction. It based on the way the formula has been developed over time, clearly larger cities and particularly city governments that are poorer in nation or in nature than wealthier jurisdictions receive bigger shared revenue payments. So a city like Milwaukee, 20 years ago, roughly 40% of Milwaukee's overall general purpose budget was comprised of shared revenues from the state. So if a revenue source that is 40% of your overall budget is never going up, that's going to have a much bigger consequence for you than, say, a smaller municipality where maybe it's only 5 or 10% of their budget. That said, shared revenue is a very important revenue source for dozens, if not hundreds, of cities and villages across the state of Wisconsin. And the fact that, again, this source of revenue is not increasing from year to year is putting more pressure on the other major source of revenue, which is the property tax, which in the case of Milwaukee has now somersaulted above shared revenue. So it used to be that shared revenue was about 40% of the budget, property taxes in the low 20s. Now that has been completely reversed. But as Jason said, because of the restrictions on the property tax, you really have what amounts to a fiscal straitjacket for those local governments that are really highly dependent on these two sources of revenue.
Talking to Rob Henken and Jason Stein about how we fund local governments in Wisconsin, the biggest cities, the smallest towns, all points in between, and the idea of shared revenue. Money flows in income and sales tax to the state. Some of it flows back to the local governments. Local governments say, not enough anymore. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments, your questions. Are there changes you'd like to see made? Are you someone involved in creating a budget at the local level? How does this affect your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, Jason, I had, you know, because of my job here, a rough idea of how this works in Wisconsin. What I didn't really realize till reading your reports is what an outlier Wisconsin is compared to all the other Midwestern states. Can you talk about ways in which things are really run differently here?
Sure. I mean, the big difference is, you know, we get about the same share of our local government budgets from taxes in Wisconsin as other states in the Midwest. The difference is, you know, for local governments in the state, particularly cities and villages, you know, the property tax is almost the only game in town for them. They have a little bit, you know, some municipalities have room taxes. They get a little bit from that. Some municipalities have local vehicle registration fees, but the reality is the property tax accounts for more than 90% of all local government taxes in the state. And so when you think about the constraints on that, that makes it difficult. In other states in the Midwest, it's common to see cities and villages, or cities at least, have sales taxes that they can levy. You do see some states like Michigan and Ohio with municipal income taxes. And so the difference is, in Wisconsin, about the same share of the budget comes from taxes, but it's not a mix of taxes. It's just one.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Mac is with us in Milwaukee. Mac, hello.
Hi. I think one thing that's typically elided in this conversation is that by this point, it has to be on purpose. The Republicans in the state legislature and the assembly, they're straitjacketing Milwaukee and other metropolitan areas because they control the purse strings, and they don't want metropolitan areas to be able to control themselves, or municipalities to be able to fund parks and do nice things. And it then reinforces their narrative that those places are broken, and they can further demonize those places and impoverish them. And it's really sad. I don't see a way out, but it's more of a political dynamic as well as a fiscal one.
Mac, thanks for the call. Rob, I don't know if you want to get into the partisan politics behind this, but has there been a strong case to be made for doing the things the way we do them now and funding from the state to the local governments at the level we're doing now? Has there been an argument saying, yeah, we're doing it right?
So I think, again, we try very hard not to get into the motivations of different lawmakers and the politics of what's going on. I will say that the point at which the shared revenue pot stopped growing was at around the same point in time that the state made a very consequential decision to try to fund 2/3 of the cost of public K-12 schools. Clearly, the state of Wisconsin has had its own budget constraints. And one of the things that we did see, whether deliberately or not, was this greater commitment to K-12 schools resulted in less of a commitment to cities and villages and counties and towns. And that's just the way it has played out. That said, again, a case can be made without getting into any political or other motivation that the state has indeed, as one would certainly have hoped, as our economy has grown, the state has seen increases in its collections of these forms of taxation that it has preserved for itself in terms of the ability to levy those. And it is the notion of sharing that really has ceased over the past couple of decades.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rob Henken and Jason Stein from Wisconsin Policy Forum with us today for a look at the way Wisconsin funds local services, the parks, the police, all that local stuff, why some local leaders, mayors, and others say the system isn't working, the money is flowing to the state, not enough of it flowing back. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How is this affecting your community? Do you have questions about how this all works? Would you like to see more revenue go from the state budget to your local community or rely more on local property taxes to meet your local needs? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about Wisconsin's system to fund local government services. Rob Henken and Jason Stein with the Wisconsin Policy Forum stay with us. That organization has put out a couple of recent studies looking at shared revenue in Milwaukee and around the state, how it affects local governments, where people are seeing shortfalls in local funding, maybe looking for changes. And you could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Should, say, a city be able to levy its own sales tax, which it can't do right now, maybe an extra 0.5% like counties can right now? Do you think cities should have more, or local governments should have more latitude to raise property taxes in the absence of direct sales and income tax? Call in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jason, that local sales tax idea, some people pointed toward, you know, if I'm successful in my local city, I'm bringing in business, maybe bringing in events like a major political convention or something, I'm not really going to get a taste of that because it's going to bring in sales tax money and the sales tax money goes to the state. Is there a thought that, hey, maybe letting that local government do this directly might help solve some of this?
Sure. I mean, I think the traditional argument has been, well, that's true that you don't get directly from these consumers, but, you know, they spend money at hotels, they spend money at restaurants, stores, that sort of thing, and that those businesses in turn pay property taxes. The reality is, though, that you're not going to get an increase in property taxes because that's linked purely to what development there is. So, you know, it's only if you get so much tourism for such a sustained period of time that you actually start doing new development that would actually, you know, generate the revenue for the local government. So that's been the argument for the sales tax. The other argument would be that, you know, commuters pay that in a way that, you know, people that say, commute into work in a large urban area in a way that they don't with their property taxes, where they're paying them wherever their residence is.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Richland Center. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call. So I'm on the county board of Richland County, and we are right in the middle of this problem. We're looking at going to a referendum to try and see if the voters, you know, want to raise some of their raise their taxes to handle services. But that means we're also looking at, do we cut services if we don't pass it, and trying to keep the wages up to make sure we get good quality people in our offices is tough if we don't have that flexibility. So I guess my question is, if your guests have heard referendum ideas, successful ways of doing that, their thoughts and their input would be helpful.
And Bob, could I ask, I want to make sure we're all talking about the same thing. You're looking at raising the ceiling on your local property taxes, I'm guessing, which you would have to do under state law to raise those property taxes?
Yeah, so for our operating budget, the only way we can raise it, because our net new construction isn't high enough to do anything with, then we need to go to a referendum, which the statute allows. And at that point, we can increase our operating budget in that manner.
I gotcha, Bob. Thanks a lot for that call. Rob, are we seeing communities around the state do this? Say, hey, we're going to go to voters to try to get this exemption from that property tax limit.
Yes, there's no question that we're seeing an increasing number of local governments, both municipal governments and county governments, turning to referendum. We have seen this over the past decade or so with regard to school districts. Our organization has tracked this. The number of referenda have increased dramatically, the size, and also the approval rate. Interestingly, school districts operate under their own revenue limits. We are not seeing as many counties, though I'm beginning to hear about that more. Certainly in the southeast part of the state, we're seeing more municipal governments going very specifically to voters to ask for authorization to exceed property tax levy limits, specifically for police and fire positions. Those tend to be the areas that are really stretched thin. Neither police nor fire are subject to the Act 10 restrictions on collective bargaining. And they're, obviously these are public safety positions. It includes EMS as well. That tend to be prioritized by local governments. And so there's no question that this is a manifestation of the many, many years of seeing revenues constricted for both counties and municipalities.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Jason, the flip side of Bob's question there is, if they don't get these revenue increases, they're going to be looking at maybe serious cuts. Is that something we're seeing? We're seeing this new budget proposal in Milwaukee. Is this a common thread you're seeing of difficult choices in funding cuts?
Sure. I mean, you know, obviously we've also documented over the past 20 years that Wisconsin has seen a bigger drop in its overall state tax burden. So taxes as a share of income of practically any state in the country. So, you know, and that includes, you know, what's happened with our property tax. Our property tax ranking has dropped somewhat. So obviously on the one hand, that's a benefit to the state. On the other hand, you know, in Wisconsin, we have a government that's set up that services are delivered more at the local level than in many other states. Certain services, in particular in Wisconsin, police and law enforcement is really heavily local. In all states, fire and EMS is, you know, exclusively local practically. And so, you know, you do have those issues about whether or not there's the funding needed to carry through with some of these services. You're also seeing a lot of small communities. You know, we've talked a lot about larger communities, but you're seeing many towns also have struggles in areas like EMS, where they've traditionally relied on volunteers to respond to a limited number of emergency calls. As the population ages, you're getting more emergency calls, and you're having more difficulty finding, you know, volunteers or paid on call staff that who can, you know, show up and get there in time for these emergencies on a timely basis.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I agree with earlier calls that there's politics in here and there's also practical impact. When you've got the state government sitting on a pot of money and local governments short, it makes sense, especially since that's a point of shared revenue, to share it. Milwaukee's got its budget problems, including through the police force. And one of the candidates for running for governor is talking about wanting to fire our DA, but not talking about sending money our way to help boost local government, including for the police force. And to make things worse, I think some people in the state legislature actually want to cut further. I think last year they were discussing cutting local transit funding and stuff like that. So this is wrongheaded in my mind.
Nate, thanks for the call. In our last minute or so, Rob, you know, shared revenue is not necessarily a word on the top of mind for everybody. Doesn't really come up a lot in political debates. Are you hoping whatever people think needs to be done, are you hoping to put it on the map as an issue that people are thinking about?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. I mean, again, and this is a healthy thing for governments to take a look periodically at the way that their structures are set up. In this case, the structure for ensuring that local governments in the state have the capacity to provide the services that constituents want and at the levels that they want. But perhaps I'd like to close by saying, you know, maybe there's a piece here that both sides of the political spectrum can agree upon, and that's service sharing. We think that there is still a lot of untapped potential for local governments and local governments with their county governments to look at ways that they can share and consolidate services. And it's not just to save money and to respond to these revenue constraints, but it's also to improve service effectiveness and efficiency. So maybe there's some common ground there that can be talked about at the same time we're talking about these very real issues with regard to both shared revenues and property tax levy limits.
Thanks to both of our guests today. We've been talking to Rob Henken and Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum with us today to talk about how Wisconsin funds local services, a system known as shared revenue, some of the challenges currently facing that system, shortfalls in a lot of communities, and some ideas for improving it. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the Asian carp is an invasive species in the Midwest. Find out about the latest efforts to keep it out of the Great Lakes. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this week, I talked to Grant and Martha from the show A Way with Words about new words in the English language just added to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. We checked out some of those new words, phrases, and definitions, including yeet, pumpkin spice, drip, and more. Now, you could play along in an online contest. The Washington Post wants you to submit a short poem of 8 lines or less that includes a selection of those new words and phrases in the dictionary. You can make up to 25 submissions. Entries are due by next Tuesday night. It'd be awesome if Wisconsin could claim some top honors. So if you're adorkable, you can level up your poetry game, maybe even start a side hustle if you're successful. Just a few of the words there that are in the contest. I'm going to sit it out. My poetry skills are sus, possibly even janky. Yeet, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a little-known legal theory is about to have its day before the U.S. Supreme Court. It was an argument used by Donald Trump's legal team during the effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. On today's 1A, find out what it is and why critics fear it could upend the way federal elections are run and certified. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, as thousands of people in Wisconsin await their criminal trial, some are sitting in jail, sometimes for months. Once charged with a crime, many people are given a large cash bail, which requires them to either pay and be released or not pay and wait for trial in jail. Cash bail started as an incentive to ensure people will show up for their trial. It's become an issue in the midterm elections here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of our current system of cash bail? Do you think amounts are set too high or not high enough? Would you like another way to ensure people are showing up for their trials and to protect public safety? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Christine Scott Hayward is director and associate professor at the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. With sociologist Joshua Page, Christine researched the impact of cash bail in the U.S. and possible changes to the system. Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics of what cash bail is and why it's there. What is the intent of cash bail systems?
Well, cash bail was originally envisaged as a way to get people to show up for their trial or any other court hearings that they have. And so you use the term incentive. It's sort of a guarantee, right? There's this idea that if somebody has money on the line, they're going to be more likely to show up at trial. So those are sort of the origins. You don't need cash to have bail. So there can also be other ways, property bonds, et cetera. But it is the dominant way that people are released from jail pre-trial in the U.S.
In the public conversation, in political campaigns, the issue of public safety comes up a lot. Has it been, what is it the goal of the cash bail system to protect public safety, to make sure that people aren't out of jail committing crimes while they're waiting for their trial?
So yeah, so that is part of the bail system, and that was introduced into the U.S. in the 1980s. Until then, appearance at trial was the primary reason, but after that, public safety did become part of the conversation too. And so typically, if you want to deny bail, if you want to deny somebody pretrial release because there is a risk to public safety, you go through a special procedural hearing where, you know, the prosecutor has to demonstrate typically by clear and convincing evidence that there's a risk that they'll cause harm to a member of the public. And it's a lot more difficult to make that showing in that kind of hearing than it is to simply set a bail that's so high that a person is not going to be able to make it, and thus they're sort of going to be de facto detained, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, and this became a big topic in Wisconsin about a year ago when Daryl Brooks had paid bail for previous alleged offenses, was released from jail, and then drove into a Christmas parade in Waukesha, killing six, injuring more. That bail for previous crimes had been set originally at $1,000. A lot of people saying that wasn't high enough to protect public safety. These high-profile cases definitely enter into the debate a lot. What is your take on that and how it compares to, I guess, how cash bail normally works?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely sort of the exception to the rule, right? In most, and $1,000 may seem like a low bail to some extent, especially when you compare it to $5 million. But $1,000 is a lot of money for most people, particularly sort of the low-income people that tend to be caught up in the criminal legal system in the United States. And so I'll say a couple of things. One is that, you know, the vast majority of people who are released, whether they're on bail or some other mechanism, will show up for their court hearings. Most will not commit a crime while they're out on pretrial release. And if they do commit a crime, it's unlikely to be a violent crime. So yeah, there always are going to be sort of the exceptions where you have, you know, somebody like Mr. Brooks committing a serious violent crime while out on pretrial release. But for the most part, most people are you know, going to do what they're supposed to do, which is show up at their court hearings. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Well, I wanted to ask now, we've seen movements to reform bail, and interestingly, liberal and conservative groups getting together, including some conservative groups backed by the Koch brothers, saying, hey, mm-hmm. let's reform this. So we've seen some states overhaul their cash bail systems, get rid of them in recent years. Do we have a sense of whether that's affected things like public safety and whether people are showing up for their trial dates?
Yeah, we haven't. I mean, it's early days yet. So most of these reforms have been happening over the last few years, but early data suggests that there hasn't been a significant decrease in public safety, and you don't see lower rates of people showing up at trial. And so the reason, of course, why most people want to get rid of cash bail is because it discriminates against poor people, right? So a cash bail system basically says, you know, whether or not you get to get out of jail pending trial is based on your income and not typically on your risk or whether there's a risk of failure to appear at trial or a risk of committing a new offense. And so, you know, the consequences of that are great, right? There's a so much evidence at this point demonstrating that, you know, if you are detained pending trial, you know, you're more likely to be convicted, you're more likely to plead guilty, and to plead guilty much earlier, right, because you want to escape sort of the pretty bad jail conditions that exist in many jails. But you're also, if you're convicted, you're more likely to get a longer sentence, you're more likely to get a sentence to incarceration. And so that's sort of why so many reformers have been, you know, pushing for an elimination of cash bail.
We're talking to Christine Scott Hayward at the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach, looking at bail, cash bail, possible changes to the system in Wisconsin and around the country. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences on one side or another of the cash bail system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John joins us now in Elkhorn. John, hi.
Hello. I totally agree with your guess. I actually spent about 18 months in jail waiting on a trial because I couldn't afford the bail. Why doesn't Wisconsin have bail bonds like a lot of other states have, where then you only have to come up with like 10 or 15% of the bail and the bail bondsman comes up with the rest?
John, thanks for that call. And that is something, I don't know about unique, but an exception here in Wisconsin. We don't, as I understand it, have that bail bond system. How common is that, Christine?
It's uncommon. Most states have the bail bond system, which is, as the caller said, allow you to deposit typically 10%. I don't know if Wisconsin has something similar to what Illinois used to have, which is where you could do the 10% payment, but it went to the court rather than to a bail bond agency. And so, bail, you know, commercial bail is controversial. The only two countries in the world that have commercial bail are the United States and the Philippines. And it's been criticized for a variety of reasons. You know, while it is true that in some cases, you know, being able to pay 10%, which is a much smaller amount, will allow somebody to get out of jail. But that 10%, they'll never get back, right? That 10% is a payment for the privilege of the bail agency putting up the bail for them. There's also been a lot of stories about corruption in the bail industry. And the bail industry is supported by, you know, large insurance companies that make a lot of money from, you know, poor people. So it's a balance. On the one hand, yes, it does make it easier for some people to get out. But on the other hand, as part of a sort of a larger systemic issue, it's problematic.
And John brings up another really interesting point, Christine. He said he waited in jail a year and a half till his trial. If I'm having to wait in jail for a week because I can't pay my bail, I mean, that's not great, but it's a week. But our court systems in many cases are backed up and these trials take a long time. How big a factor in this discussion is that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big factor. You know, there are, you know, in theory, there are speedy trial rules, which generally require shorter periods of time if you're detained than if you're in the community. But for a variety of reasons, that doesn't usually help people. And I will say, though, that, you know, even a week in jail can really have strong negative impacts on, you know, on people who are detained, you know, losing jobs, losing custody of their kids. You know, there's lots of horrible stories about, you know, people who have been subjected to violence while they're in jail, committed suicide. And 18 months is a long time, but we also have stories of people who spend 3 years and even longer while they're in there.
Thanks again for that call, John. We're talking to Christine Scott Hayward, Director of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. We're looking at cash bail in Wisconsin and around the United States, reforms maybe in the works, and pushback against those reforms. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see higher cash bail in Wisconsin, especially maybe for people accused of more violent crimes? Or do you think we need to get rid of the cash bail system altogether or some point in between? Call in on 800-642-1234. And will a politician's opinion on cash bail and bail reform affect the way you vote? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Christine Scott Hayward, Director of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. Talk with her about her recently published research on cash bail and the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been through the cash bail system? Were you able to pay it, or were you stuck in jail waiting for a trial? Do you want to see the system change in one way or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Marcus?
Okay, so I think that, like, with pretty much everything in this world, it's worth taking a second look at and seeing if there is, you know, a possible better way. I would say that some reforms are necessary what they are. I don't know exactly. My concern is with getting rid of the no cash bail is you could literally have people who are innocent that were upstanding members of society sitting in jail because they couldn't pay the cash bail because lots of us are living paycheck to paycheck. And so then while they're in there, they lose their job, they lose their apartment, perhaps their girlfriend, significant other, whatever. You know, they lose their property, they lose their car, you know, and then they're coming out in a situation where it's like, I already lost all this for a crime I didn't commit simply because I couldn't bail out. And I don't think that's right either.
Marcus, thanks for that call. Christine, Marcus worried about the impact this might have someone, especially someone ultimately acquitted in a trial of that long period in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's absolutely right. Those are many of the consequences. And there's no compensation, right? There's no compensation for that time that you spend in there. And we have cases of people who've spent years waiting for a trial and then eventually, you know, charges are dismissed. Many people have heard of the case of Khalif Browder, who was a 16-year-old when he was arrested and spent 3 years in Rikers Island in New York, where he was, you know, abused, spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. He kept being offered plea deals, you know, just plead guilty, this low-level offense, and then you can get out. Then they'd offer him another one. He kept saying, no, I didn't do anything. I'm not pleading guilty to a crime I didn't commit. Ultimately, the prosecutors just dropped the charges, after which he'd spent 3 years in jail. And sadly, 3 months later, he committed suicide. And, you know, and that's a particularly horrible story. But, you know, as the caller said, the consequences are severe.
Thanks for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. Karen joins us now in Luck. Karen, hi.
Hey, thanks for having this conversation. I work with a lot of people who are coming out of incarceration and who are in recovery. And many of them were put in jail because of felony bail jumping. And that seems to me to be a poor person's crime. And it should be unconstitutional, but it's not. And I'm wondering what kinds of things can we do legislatively to correct this?
Karen, thanks for the call. Christine, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I'm not an expert on Wisconsin law, but I am aware of that in Wisconsin, unlike in other places, that offense is a felony rather than a misdemeanor, which can exacerbate some of the issues described earlier. I think it just does come back to the fact that, you know, these are crime, you know, that's a crime, and this system essentially, as I've said before, discriminates against poor people. You know, you have examples of people who've been given an extremely high bail and just sort of say, hey, I don't need that money. I'm just going to, you know, abscond, leave it behind and move on. And, you know, the small amounts that some people say, you know, that are too small, as I said before, are just very difficult for people to pay. And so people are left with a choice of, you know, I think I'm innocent, or I think I have a really good chance of fighting this offense and maybe getting a good deal, but I can either, you know, plead guilty now and get out and perhaps not have too much of an interruption to my life, or I can sit here and wait and hope that I'll be able to achieve that outcome.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Christine Scott Hayward, criminal justice expert at California State University, Long Beach, looking at bail, cash bail in particular, what the system looks like, how it works, possible changes. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christine, focusing in on the public safety example, you mentioned that there is a way to say, okay, this person who's awaiting trial, we think represents a very significant danger if they were at large. Is there a way to improve that system, make it work better, and uncouple it from the cash bail system so that the sort of the backdoor solution isn't, okay, you're dangerous, so we're going to set, you know, a $5 million cash bail to make sure you can't get out?
Yeah, I mean, that system exists in the majority of states. And, you know, to my knowledge, it is the same system that operates in Wisconsin. So they shouldn't be separate. But what I know from talking to some people who work in this system itself is that it's just a lot easier to set a high bail. The standards, as I said before, are much lower. It's difficult to sort of prove and predict whether one particular individual is actually going to pose a danger, right? We're making educated guesses most of the time based on factors that tend to predict things, but that, you know, we can never really know about one particular individual. Illinois, in its reforms that go into effect next year, sort of narrowed their exception. So in Illinois now, you actually have to demonstrate that there's a specific threat to a specific person, which will make it a little harder to detain people in that way. I think that makes it a little better in some ways, but then you could also argue, well, you know, if it's harder to do it that way, then we're going to revert to the other system if that's still on the books.
Now, the politics of this make it a very touchy subject. As I mentioned, there were some bipartisan efforts at reform for a while there. Then an election season comes along and crime becomes a hot button issue. Do you see a change and progress happening in fits and starts because of that kind of politics?
Yeah, I mean, like anything in the criminal legal system, politics matters. And when crime goes up, everybody's trying to explain sort of why did crime jump? What are some of these, you know, we made these reforms. Did any of those reforms have a particular impact? And it's very difficult to make that connection, but it's sort of an easy target. I think one thing I would say is that, you know, the places that have been sort of successful, like New Jersey, have had buy-in from, you know, most agencies and sort of a wider coalition, and you have to be ready to sort of, you know, there are going to be those cases, right? There's always going to be the exception, where somebody who is released, under a no bail system, you know, then does something bad. But I think we have to remember that unless we lock, you know, everybody up, including all of the innocent people, you know, you're never going to be 100% secure. And also remember that people can still commit offenses while they are locked up, right?
Bring on another caller now. Petra is with us in La Crosse. Petra, hi.
Hi. So my question or my comment is that people can be charged with any crime for very little evidence and then sit in jail for long periods of time if they can't cash bond out. And I'm just wondering what she thinks about that.
Petra, thanks for the call. What do you think, Christine?
I think she's absolutely right. So let's remember that in order to charge somebody, the standard is probable cause, right? Which is a fair probability that a crime is being committed and that this person committed the crime. It's a not particularly high standard, right? So you can sit in jail based on a probable cause standard when, you know, at trial or, you know, at when a person pleads guilty, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's a big gap between those two things. We know that for any particular act, you know, you could charge it as any number of things. I sat in on a bail hearing once that involved a woman who'd gotten into a fight at a bar. The police showed up. She ended up sort of pushing the police officer. And then somehow she ended up, you know, charged with multiple counts of, you know, felony assault of a police officer, right? You could charge that crime in a very different way. And the likelihood of her being convicted of that particular charge later down the road is probably unlikely. And so I think the caller is correct that, you know, the standard is really pretty low in terms of, you know, what we need to actually charge somebody with.
Thanks for that call, Petra. In just our last minute or so, Christine, what for you are the big unanswered questions about our cash bail system that maybe future research could help resolve?
Yeah, I mean, I think we still don't know a lot about the alternatives, right? So we have some information coming in, but most states haven't abolished it entirely. And we also don't know whether the alternatives that have been proposed are going to be effective. So, you know, you can just release people on their own recognizance and then provide them services like, you know, notifications, text reminders that their court appearance is coming up, provide some sort of, services if there are needs that relate to their appearance. Risk assessment has become popular, and there's some evidence that that does help reduce the number of people locked up, but there are also problems with risk assessment. So I think, you know, we need more states to sort of actually take the leap and abolish cash bail, because, you know, most of what we have, most of the evidence that we have so far suggests that it's not going to have a negative impact on public safety or appearance rates. But we only have that evidence for a few years from a few states.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Christine Scott Hayward, director and associate professor at the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at California State University, Long Beach. She joined us today to talk about her research on cash bail. You can still share your thoughts on cash bail itself and the politics that surround it in an election year. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, find out why some Wisconsin communities are considered as food deserts with limited access to affordable and healthy food. And check out some of the latest efforts to get food to where it's needed. And some states have a binding statewide referendum process to change laws. Wisconsin doesn't. Should we? We'll look at the pros and cons, and you can tell us what you think. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.